WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our film critic John Powers, who is also film critic for Vogue, just returned from the Sundance Film Festival, which wrapped up on Sunday in Park City, Utah. It's the most important American showcase for independent films. For the filmmakers, it's the best place to be noticed. For Hollywood producers, agents, and distributors, it's the place to find new talent. For film critics, it's the place to preview new films, some which are likely to become big hits, some which may never even make it to theaters. I asked John if there were any themes that emerged from the films this year at Sundance.
Well, the interesting thing about Sundance is that, you know, because it's an independent film festival, traditionally a lot of the films are kind of grim and alienated. And perhaps there's some sort of cultural changeover, or maybe just a change in the psyche of the selection committee, because this year's festival was packed with romantic comedies. You know, it was filled with sweet stories, both gay and straight, about couples who managed to make it together by the end of the film. So even when you had a film about an alienated ex-con who returns home to his parents who didn't love him, by the end of the film, he actually has found the woman who loves him.
What won the biggest awards this year?
Yes, well, the grand prize winner and clearly the sensation of the festival was a film called Slam. It was directed by Mark Levin and stars a really charismatic performer named Saul Williams. He plays a young black poet, a brilliant young black poet, who gets busted in D.C. for having maybe 4 ounces of marijuana and is basically sent to jail initially and told he has to more or less cop a plea or he'll go to jail for 10 years. But it starts off as sort of a socially conscious, verite-style drama about this poet. But what happens is it basically turns into something like a musical, because at different points in the film, he just starts spouting poetry, or other people start spouting poetry. And the film actually is about a double meaning of the word slam. It's both being thrown into the slammer as a prisoner, but also the poetry slams that they have, where people recite poetry. And what's interesting about the film is you're watching this film that looks for all the world like a grim prison documentary that then later the guy gets out on the street, but it's a grim verite-style documentary. But like a musical, it stops for these kind of otherworldly sequences of people performing really brilliantly. So when I saw the film, it was interrupted constantly by applause. Each time somebody would finish a poetic number, the audience would applaud. It's actually an interesting film, although I think in lots of ways not a very good film. It's kind of naive, because the conflict between the verite style and the kind of musical style, doesn't really hold together. But the film is very powerful because of the performers. The other thing I would say is it's a very weird experience to sit in Utah in an audience filled with agents, watching them weep and applaud poems by people that they would sooner die than sit next to anywhere else in real life.
Were the performers in this movie real poets?
Yeah, they are real poets. And in fact, after each show, they would sort of get up and sort of do poetry for the audience in the Q&A period. And as I say, the lead actor, Saul Williams, is extraordinarily charismatic. And he more or less carries the movie because he's able to pull off sequences that are in lots of ways extraordinarily implausible. By the standards of realism of the visual style of the film, the scenes are extremely implausible. At one point, he's about to be murdered in the prison yard by somebody, and instead he begins giving this incredible sort of poetic rap, and all the prisoners stand around transfixed and amazed. Now, I suspect in the real world he would simply be killed, but in the logic of this film, his rap is so brilliant that even enemies are stunned and they stop and they realize he's some kind of driven genius.
This film sounds really different from most of the films that you described at the festival as being, you know, romantic comedies.
Yes, well, I think perhaps it stood out because it was probably the most emotionally intense film for people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also it too is an affirmative film because it starts with a guy being thrown in jail, but gradually more or less coming to terms with that part of his life and making peace with the fact that this suffering in prison is part of what it's going to take to nurture his genius. So in fact, it actually ends up in a weird way, sort of an upbeat film on a very downbeat subject. Because I mean, one of the really depressing things about watching the film, which is set in, you know, the D.C. prisons, is you look and you see that every single person in the prison is a black man and pretty much a young black man.
The Best Director Award went to a movie called Pie, What is this about?
Yes, well, it's important to explain that pi refers to the mathematical symbol, not the dessert. It's a film by Darren Aronofsky, who's a 28-year-old guy with a lot of talent. And it's about a mathematical genius who becomes obsessed with the idea that he can use mathematics to understand more or less reality. He starts off being fascinated by trying to see if he can use math to predict the exact workings of the stock market. Not because he particularly wants the money, but because he thinks that math underlies everything. And so it's an intellectual challenge for him. Then later he gets involved with this kind of Kabbalistic sect and starts looking at the Torah and begins thinking that maybe somehow underlying both the Torah and the stock market are the same numerical principles. The film is basically about a math genius who goes kind of berserk trying to pursue the largest meaning of things in mathematical terms. What's interesting to me is that it strikes me as being the intellectual version of something like Good Will Hunting. Because in Good Will Hunting, you have the same mathematical genius, but in a peculiarly American twist, it's an anti-intellectual film about a genius. So that the Matt Damon character in Good Will Hunting, you know, is another Einstein, yet what the film thinks is interesting about him is that he had a really bad upbringing and, you know, more or less can't get his life together. Whereas in Pi, there's the suggestion that if you're a genius at the level of this guy, you start noticing patterns so deep and profound that your entire perception of reality is different from everybody else's. So that, and the film more or less is shot completely from the point of view of the math genius, so that when he steps out on the street, what he notices, what he feels, the sounds he hears, all suggest his genius, that he is not like us, and that the world is an extremely complicated place for him that isn't like the world would be if you're not this particular genius. It's a very interesting film. It probably is the best directed film of the entire festival. And if I had to name the one person whose next film I most wanted to see, it would be Darren Aronofsky.
Okay, and the film is called Pi. Does it have a distributor, or are we likely to see it soon?
Yes, it actually does have a distributor. I mean, you know, one of the funny things about Sundance in general is that the question of who gets distribution comes to take over the entire festival. In fact, the great joke of Sundance is that the festival prides itself on not being commercial. I mean, there's no festival in the world where you hear more speeches about art, integrity, and all the rest. Yet there's no festival in the world where more of the talk is actually devoted to whose film has been bought, who's a rising star, all of the commercial side of the business. In the case of Pi, it was picked up, although many people thought it wouldn't do a lot of business because it's about an intellectual topic. And it's generally thought in film circles, both independent and Hollywood, that if you make a film about smart people, you're in real trouble.
The Filmmakers Trophy, which is an award given by filmmakers to filmmakers, is the film that also won the Audience Award. And that's called Smoke Signals. And I know that it was written by Sherman Alexie, who is a Native American writer who's written short stories and I think a novel as well. Did you like the movie?
The movie's okay. It's my sort of condescending term for there's a particular kind of movie that Sundance has, which I guess is the kind of cute ethnics film. And Smoke Signals has a little bit of that. It's about two guys more or less seeking out one of the guy's fathers. But it's filled with jokes and kind of high spirits and, you know, a sense of dislocation and search for the self. And the film is actually quite enjoyable to watch, although it's sort of a mess. The script by Sherman Alexie is very funny, and the performances are very, very good. There's a very touching performance by the Native American actor Gary Farmer, who people might have seen in Dead Man and some other films.
He was great in Dead Man.
Yeah, he's really great, and he actually has real charisma. And in fact, the performers are very strong, and the script is funny, yet in lots of ways it's a kind of clumsy film. So if you go to see it expecting a piece of great storytelling or a sort of well-crafted film, you'll be disappointed. If you go expecting something that's sort of amiable and heartfelt, that's clunky at parts, but actually has jokes of a kind you don't normally see, and more or less represents a point of view of the world, which is to say the Native American view of their own lives, then you actually you will see something you'll enjoy. The audience loved it a lot. I mean, I can't honestly say I think it's a really good film, but I was quite happy to have seen it.
If you could give out an award to a film that didn't receive an award, what film would it be?
Well, I think the tricky thing at Sundance is that a lot of the best films aren't officially in competition. Now, this is partly a good thing. I mean, the best single feature film there that I hadn't seen before was Paul Schrader's film Affliction, based on the Russell Banks novel, which is the beautiful story of Nick Nolte, who plays a sort of small-town loser, and his relationship to his overbearing father. And it's a beautiful, harrowing film, perhaps the best performance of Nolte's career. Certainly, I think a better performance than any of the Oscar nominees this year will be. I mean, a really wonderful film made by Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver and has made a bunch of other films. It's the best film of his career. It's a really wonderful piece of work. And I think perhaps in something that kind of typifies what's going on in American film right now, it doesn't have a distributor, partly because it's a downer subject, partly because The Sweet Hereafter, which is also based on a Russell Banks novel, didn't do very good business. And I think partly because Schrader is a known commodity. What happens at Sundance and lots of places is that distributors buy relationships with young talent. So it's not at all uncommon that when a film like a romantic comedy like Next Stop Wonderland is bought by Miramax, they will also then have a two-picture deal for the next two films by the young director, because everybody wants to sort of sign up the young talent, because it's such a competitive business. But Paul Schrader has been around a long time. He's a known commodity. People know that a lot of his movies don't make money, so that there's not quite the same advantage. Yet he had, I think, clearly the best feature film at the festival, I mean, by quite a lot.
My guest is Fresh Air film critic John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with our film critic, John Powers. We're talking about the Sundance Film Festival, which concluded on Sunday. There was a big controversy at the Sundance Film Festival this year over a documentary movie about Kurt Cobain, the late lead singer of Nirvana, and Courtney Love, who was his wife and also starred in the Larry Flint movie. The festival withdrew the movie after being pressured by... I think Courtney Love's lawyers. What was this controversy about?
Well, I think it's probably important to start talking about the film. The film is about the relationship between Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain, in particular the death of Kurt Cobain. You know, and there's been a lot of stuff on the internet for quite a while suggesting, in one way or another, that Courtney Love was either indirectly responsible for Kurt Cobain's death, or more dramatically, that she'd actually arranged to have Kurt Cobain murdered. The film essentially focuses on this subject, or at least that's what it starts off looking at. And it sort of like goes through all the evidence, it talks to the various conspiracy theorists, it interviews a guy who claims that Courtney Love offered him $50,000 to kill Kurt Cobain. And that's the basic idea in it. And it's easy to understand why Courtney Love would not exactly love to have a documentary out suggesting that she murdered Kurt Cobain. But the film is made by a British filmmaker named Nick Broomfield, who sort of specializes in kind of story about women who are on the verge of more or less notorious women. There's one named Eileen Wuornos, a serial killer. He made a film about Heidi Fleiss. He made a film about Margaret Thatcher. And what he always does is he builds in his making the film as part of the structure of what he's doing. So the film is not only about whether or not Courtney Love killed Kurt Cobain, but it also becomes about Courtney Love's attempt to stop him from making the film about Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love. And this also would be upsetting to Courtney Love, because it's filled with tapes of her shrieking vile obscenities at people, threatening to destroy people's lives, clearly being dishonest in her presentation of herself. So for both of those reasons, it's a film she doesn't want out. And through different kinds of legal pressure, including the music company refusing rights to some of the songs that were in the film, it became clear that if Sundance showed it, there'd be probably some huge legal problem. The solution to this was that after they withdrew the film, Sundance decided not to show it, one of the dissident film festivals that also took place in Park City, a thing called Slam Dunk, had a midnight screening of the film for about 100 people who I think they thought would be to the benefit of the film to see. So there were journalists there, film distributors, various celebrities. And so we all huddled in this kind of wood-lined elk's lodge, with actually no dead elk heads on the wall, and watched this film being projected. And it was, you know, one of the sensations of the festival, because it's filled with interesting and wonderful things. I mean, my favorite detail in the entire film is when Nick Broomfield, the filmmaker, goes off to meet the guy who claims that he was offered money to kill Kurt Cobain. The person who brokers the deal is Divine Brown's pimp. And, you know, that kind of weird sense of intersecting layers of sleaze and madness is really wonderful in the film. And there's also a wonderful thing at the end where Broomfield crashes an ACLU award ceremony where Courtney Love is presenting an award for freedom of speech. And he basically asks the question from the stage, why are you letting this woman who's suppressed and threatened and bullied reporters be a spokesperson for freedom of speech? And he has the triumphant moment of more or less having the ACLU throw him off the stage for engaging in freedom of speech in an award ceremony devoted to freedom of speech. So it was quite a sensational film. I don't know whether it'll ever come out. There's lots of talk that distributors want it, but the legal problems have to be enormous because the film explicitly says that the filmmaker doesn't believe that Courtney Love had Kurt Cobain killed, yet gives so much evidence that he sort of does believe it, that it's a very insinuating film.
Well, I believe that the people who tried to get Sundance to withdraw the film and succeeded in getting them to withdraw the film were also saying that the filmmaker didn't properly own the music rights to a couple of the songs used in the movie.
Yes, well, the music rights argument was the basic argument, although I think no one at Sundance actually believed that was the real problem. Partly because this was a film made for a British television channel, and they traditionally have waivers that allow them to use music in films when they're shown at festivals. But I think the idea was that no music company was probably going to sue Sundance for having two screenings of a film. But this was just, I think, part of the full court press on the part of the Courtney Love team in order to have the film not shown. And it worked very well. And you know, I must say that you know there is something slightly unsavory about the film. Broomfield's work is on that sort of fine line between sleaze and serious journalism. I can sort of imagine that his next film will be about Linda R. Tripp because it's perfectly there. You know, it's always the case of something that looks kind of tabloidy, yet also raises serious issues.
Which leads me to this subject. While Sundance was underway, network anchors were using the term oral sex and describing the latest controversy surrounding our president. And I'm wondering how this dramatic story affected the people at Sundance, especially considering that Clinton has been considered the Hollywood president in some ways. A lot of people in the movie industry were pretty solidly behind him during his campaigns.
Yes. Well, I think the first thing to be said is that movie people do not use terms like oral sex in discussing the Clinton episode. They are much more direct in their discussion of it. It was actually funny because the news sort of seeped through the walls of the festival very slowly. I remember talking to Michael Moore, who you all know from Roger and Me, who had a film at the festival. And he'd shown his film at the festival and had made a couple jokes about it, and no one in the audience laughed. And he realized that at the time that he had made those jokes, people hadn't yet heard. So they probably just thought he was making some sort of weird, gratuitous swipe about Clinton's sex life, you know. But by the end of the festival, it was talked about as much as anything else. Partly people were tired because festivals are very exhausting and hermetic and sort of self-absorbing things. And by about the end of 7 or 8 days, you need desperately to have some sort of contact with the outer world. And, you know, what could be a better contact with the outer world than allegations against the president of this kind? So every morning you'd wake up and people would say, oh, I'm really exhausted. I got in from my screening at 12:30. And then I turned on CNN and watched until 2:30 because everyone was fascinated by it. And because it also, this kind of story has a kind of Hollywood aspect to it. I mean, not only do you have the film Wag the Dog, which is part of it. You have primary colors. But as you mentioned, Hollywood is particularly interested in Clinton. And there's the whole question in the film business of how you present yourself in relation to society. And this actually sort of raises all sorts of delicate and interesting PR issues. I mean, how do you handle a story like this if you're the White House is a thing that's very, very fascinating to lots of people in the film business, whether or not you're publicists, whether or not you're trying to promote a film. I mean, so the sort of technique of it all became a fascinating thing.
My guest is Fresh Air film critic John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.